Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide in Tandunya, on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
So we think we need to be incentivising the uptake of EVs, not adding charges that don't account for the health benefits that are gained from on the roads.
Labor's three-day economic reform roundtable thrust road user changing into the spotlight, with the Treasurer signalling it as a tax reform priority. But not all agree. Also, it's almost 4 years since the Taliban regained power in Afghanistan, and a dire situation continues to build for women and vulnerable ethnic groups. So how can the international community respond? And later...
You know, we don't have to work in silos as individual language groups, but we can work on one thing with sports in the middle of it, and different language groups can talk about sports.
Over in Brisbane, the launch of a sports newsroom is gearing up to boost diversity in media. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, and a content warning, the following contains discussion of domestic violence, which may be distressing for some. Over 5,000 voices of lived experience. That's how many spoke up to inform South Australia's first Royal Commission into Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence. The final report, centering largely on those voices, was handed down Tuesday. Commissioner Natasha Stott Despoja told media some of the stories will haunt me and my team forever, while Premier Peter Malinauskas said Voices, an additional report, included some pretty harrowing stories. The 700-page report, With Courage, South Australia's Vision Beyond Violence, includes four key pillars and 136 recommendations, sparking hope amongst advocacy organisations that this could offer a pathway to change. Embolden is the peak body for specialist domestic, family and sexual violence services in SA. I spoke with CEO Mary Leaker to hear more.
As a sector, we'll take some time to consider and respond to the Commissioner's recommendations in detail. But absolutely, you know, this report reflects really powerfully the voices of South Australians with lived and living experience of domestic, family and sexual violence. It really does represent a blueprint for transformative change.
In November 2023, four women in South Australia lost their lives, allegedly at the hands of their partner, prompting an outpouring of calls for a Royal Commission into the crisis. Ms. Leaker says that week was termed the worst in the country for domestic violence fatalities.
That week in late 2023, we understood then and understand now that it was the worst week for fatal domestic and family violence ever recorded in any Australian jurisdiction. That moment really galvanised, certainly Embolden and our members, colleagues across the broader social and community services sector and the broader community to really say enough is enough. So we stood together on the steps of Parliament House to call for a Royal Commission. But as I've mentioned publicly previously, Embolden's members had written to the Premier even before that week to call for a Royal Commission and to really highlight the chronic underfunding of our service system and the really critical need for system reform, because we knew that people were falling through the gap.
A key observation and concern is a culture issue that becomes entrenched, or has entrenched rather, certain behavioural perceptions that ultimately enable physical, mental and sexual violence. Do you think the Royal Commission addressed this enough, and do you have hope for systemic change and broader social reform in that regard?
Definitely. I mean, there is a strong focus in the report on, you know, ensuring that we have a community with a really strong understanding of the nature and dynamics of domestic, family and sexual violence, and I think that's important. And there is a strong focus on what we call primary prevention, which is prevention activities that are really designed at a whole of population level. So I think that's really important. Those activities alone won't drive drive, I think, the significant change that we need to see. And so we're pleased to see the very strong focus alongside that focus on primary prevention, really on system reform.
The South Australian Council of Social Service are one of the many organisations that welcome the Royal Commission report. While SACOS highlight they don't provide frontline services, they acknowledge the report reflects the impacts of the housing crisis and a need for increased services to respond to victim survivors. SACOS CEO Dr. Catherine Earle with more.
We think the Royal Commission's report is very well considered and comprehensive, and we're really pleased that it's bringing together the experiences of thousands of victim survivors and service providers and other important stakeholders. So we think that the report really provides this very good blueprint for the government in going forward and a really comprehensive set of recommendations.
The report acknowledges the impact of the housing crisis and lack of available housing stock. Can you elaborate any further here from a social services position?
So it's really clear that the housing crisis is compounding the issues of domestic and family and sexual violence in our state and contributing to the crisis for victim survivors. People who are experiencing violence sometimes have to stay in very unsafe home environments where they're exposed to violence just because they have no other option other than staying or being forced into homelessness and very inadequate and insecure housing. Most recent data tells us that over 3,500 women and children seek help from homelessness and housing providers in a year. We really support the recommendations in the Royal Commission report around housing.
The Commission acknowledges the state's response system is crisis-driven, fragmented, and often siloed, with structural reform focused on creating a cohesive and effective system. Ms. Leaker also points to the need for an integrated approach.
That is really critical. You know, we have a system where victim survivors, you know, people with lived and living experience report feeling like they're knocking on the wrong door and can't get the help that they need. At a fundamental level, we want to create a system where there is no wrong door, and there are strong recommendations around creating an integrated response model that is place-based. So the idea that, you know, no matter who you are or where you live in South Australia, there's somewhere that you can go where you'll receive a holistic response to your needs. That's something certainly that Embolden and our members have called for, and we're pleased to see those recommendations in the report.
I understand that there were 5,000 harrowing stories of lived experience that informed the Royal Commission, but I also understand that lived experience will help inform solutions moving into the future. How vital is this aspect, and have voices of lived experience been left out for too long, do you think?
This report reflects really powerfully the voices of South Australians with lived and living experience, and that's a key strength of the work that the Commissioner and her team have done.
CEO of Embolden, Mary Leaker, speaking with me. If you or someone you know is struggling with domestic violence, help is available. Call 1-800-RESPECT, that's 1-800-737-732, or 13YARN, that's 139276.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Labor's three-day economic reform roundtable put forward some bold ideas, with the event casting light on road user charging, also known as road pricing. Treasurer Jim Chalmers signalled it as a tax reform priority, with the Productivity Commission Chair indicating support. Helen Rowe, Transport Program Manager at the Climate Works Centre, said it would be a powerful tool for boosting productivity and building economic resilience. But industry voices have elevated concerns that the tax reform could decrease the transition to electric vehicles, arguing EV owners already contribute through various taxes. She warns the move could also bring environmental and health implications. The Wire's Jordan Zarella spoke with Michelle Isles, CEO of Climate and Health Alliance, to find out more.
I think these have played a really critical role in removing tailpipe emissions, so the pollution that significantly impacts the health and well-being of our community. Pollution is a negative externality that harms health. So we think we need to be incentivizing the uptake of EVs, not adding charges that don't account for the health benefits that are gained from on the roads.
Many places across the world, from New York to London, have implemented similar tax reforms for electric vehicles. If this tax comes into effect, how do you think road user charges could influence the adoption of electric vehicles?
We initially saw steady growth in the uptake of EVs, and there have been incentives in place. But with some of the rollback of those, coupled with some misinformation that are impacting buyers' perceptions, we're not seeing the growth that Australia should be having. We are concerned that extra charge at this point in time will influence and impact sales and uptake of EV at a time when we need it most. It's probably not well known, but Australian cities from one source, which is pollution from vehicles, is above the standards that the World Health Organization. So it's disappointing that this is not being considered in the sort of isolated policies being to solve a road problem.
The Parliamentary Budget Office has warned that the fuel excess collection tax raised just over $15 billion in 2024, but could fall to zero by 2050 as electric vehicles replace fuel-powered cars. What's your thoughts on this?
What unfortunately the Australian government does is also subsidise the expansion of fossil fuels, which causes direct health harms. So there is money across the budget that could be redistributed. Then it'll open up other revenue streams through avoided harm to be able to fund the services and infrastructure that we need.
Helen Rowe, Transport Manager at Climate Works Centre, says discussions on road pricing have been ongoing for decades in Australia, calling for the need to adapt to the road user charge, whilst also ensuring does not slow down the electric vehicle transition.
Well, I think the important thing to think about is that we've been talking about something like road pricing for many decades in Australia, and it's good to differentiate between how we've been talking about it in the past and now. So in the past, we've been talking about commonly around the world, people have used road pricing, like congestion pricing, or even in London, emissions-based charging. Somewhere like Singapore or London, in busy centres of the city where we've got too many cars, they put in place a cordon charge and these kinds of things, and that reduces congestion. Often that also gets invested into things like, if you're going to make it more expensive to drive into the city, that money gets reinvested into things like sustainable transport. Now we're talking about road pricing, but for electric vehicles to replace the fuel excise tax that we use to cover the costs of road infrastructure and maintenance. We are looking at seriously now because we need a replacement for fuel excise. But let's make sure we don't provide disincentives for EV uptake. It makes sense that everyone needs to contribute to the infrastructure they use, but making sure we don't slow down that EV transition because it's not happening fast enough in Australia.
Some industry voices support a road user charge once electric vehicles make up 30% of new sales, arguing that electric vehicle owners already contribute through taxes and that the idea of a free ride is misleading. How do you view that perspective?
I think what we really should be considering is putting all vehicles on the same system. If I was thinking about buying an EV and there was road user pricing for EVs and there's a per litre cost on petrol, is that really advantageous for me to buy an EV? You'll see in Climate Works Centre Transport Modelling, we're looking at over 70% of new vehicle sales being EVs by 2030, being in line with achieving a one.
The Wire's Jordan Zarella with that story. I'm Emma Watsky and you're listening to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. A huge hello to Three-Way Radio in Warrnambool and to our friends at ACCC in Alice Springs and, of course, to Tune FM in Armidale. Since the collapse of the Afghanistan Democratic Government in August 2021, the landlocked nation has slowly drifted out of the global spotlight as the Taliban has again cemented its rule across the territory. This has led to a dire situation for the people of Afghanistan, with the Taliban enforcing laws that marginalise women and target other vulnerable ethnic groups. Stephen Hill asked Nemat Yulay Ibrahimi, a senior research fellow at the University of Melbourne, how serious is the human rights situation in Afghanistan since US and NATO troops had left?
Since they forcefully took control of Afghanistan in August of 2021, the Taliban has been slowly and systematically dismantling the basic institutions of the rule of law that would protect the human rights of the citizens of the country. The Taliban leader, Mullah Hibatullah Akhundzada, has been issuing a series of decrees, around 200, that has been restricting some of the most fundamental human rights of the citizens of Afghanistan.
Among the biggest losers of the return to Taliban have been women who now find themselves marginalised by laws that restrict their movement, their ability to access education or to gain employment. Can you talk a bit about the current state of gender apartheid being enforced by the Taliban?
This is a very systematic and pervasive system that is discriminating against women and girls in every aspect of their life. Take the example of education. Women and girls are not allowed to go to high school beyond the grade 6. They're not allowed to go to universities. And they are not allowed to work in many sectors of the economy. Women and girls are policed, and they are very regularly harassing people, you know, picking up young girls and women from the streets and into detention centres, and where in those places are also subjected to mistreatment and torture.
Also, with witnessing the continual persecution of ethnic minorities such as the Hazaras and many other religious dominations.
Well, the Taliban's system of rule is really creating a very rigid hierarchy among various ethnic and religious groups in the country. So the Taliban are mainly Deobandi Muslims, mainly clerics, and they are drawn from a particular group within the predominantly Sunni Pashtun communities. And they have systematically excluded other groups from power. But at the bottom of this hierarchy is groups such as Hazaras, who are predominantly Shias, and they have been systematically excluded from the government. People who are appointed in government positions, they have been purged. At the same time, locally, in areas where the Hazaras live, they have been subjected to regular displacement from their lands and where they have lived for generations. And there are also regular reports of Hazaras being killed either at the hands of the Taliban or the hands of pro-Taliban groups who are now back in the central highlands of Afghanistan, which is Hazara majority region of the country.
Another major issue is food security. Human rights watch suggesting that half of Afghanistan's population needing urgent humanitarian aid, with 12.4 million facing food insecurity. How serious is the situation on the ground when it comes to accessing basic necessities?
Well, the situation has been extremely dire over the past 4 years. Afghanistan was a country which was heavily dependent on foreign aid. When the foreign aid was withdrawn after 2021, the country's economy really contracted, according to some accounts, by up to 30% of the country's GDP. And as a result, the country has seen a rise in malnutrition, and the significant cut in aid is affecting the ability of aid organizations to provide some of those really fundamental services.
And we've recently seen Russia be the first state to recognise the Taliban government. Australia, on the other hand, has referred the Taliban government to the International Court of Justice based on its discriminatory policies towards women and minorities. What do you think are the best ways in which the international community can attempt to prevent the Taliban from gaining legitimacy?
The international community needs to act and respond in a very coordinated manner. Russia made that unfortunate decision to recognise the Taliban, which is, I think, probably more a geostrategic move to pull the Taliban towards their sphere of influence. At the same time, I think the democratic world also needs to step in and mobilize their efforts and resources in a coordinated manner to respond to the gravity of the situation. I think both human rights but also humanitarian situation in a manner that is not rewarding the Taliban's atrocities, the Taliban's repression of human rights in Afghanistan.
Senior Research Fellow for the Initiative for Peace Building at the University of Melbourne, Nemat Yulay Ibrahimi, speaking with Stephen Hill. And And Over to Brisbane, a new project on producing sports content at Radio 4EB will be launched next week. With the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, the Community Media Training Organisation and the ABC, culturally and linguistically diverse members of the station have received training on sports coverage, interviewing and radio production. This also aims to be a step towards increasing the diversity in the media and to better connect with multicultural communities. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan attended the training and spoke with two participants to find out more.
I am Reggie. I am the project officer for the 4EB Sports Newsroom project.
So tell us a little bit more about the Sports Newsroom project.
So this project started when we made an attempt to cover the FIFA coverage 2030. In 2023, and what we did with that coverage was a small coverage. It was almost illegal because we're not supposed to use the material from FIFA, but it was just a few of us here at the station from different language groups. We really enjoyed it because it's a multicultural gathering, and then we just talk about the FIFA women's sports at that time. From that time, it became my proof of concept that we can do this at 4EB. You know, we don't have to work in silos as individual language groups, but we can work on one thing with sports in the middle of it, and different language groups can talk about sports.
So the training happened and you were participating as well. You were involved in the training with ABC, with Amanda Shalala, which was fantastic. What are the main things you learned from the training that you attended and that you organized as well?
Well, one of the key things that because we had someone from the industry, a sports journal who has been doing this for 10 years, she shared with us her workflow and how to make it efficient and also the best practices for covering. That's what did not happen when we were doing our little FIFA coverage. So I was very keen to do the sports broadcasting correctly, you know, doing the bulletins and the media laws when you are covering sports coverage, because every sport or every sports organization would have different rules on how to cover it. So that was one of the highlights in week one of her training, and I think that's very important as broadcast journalists.
What are the highlights of the training that you take that you will be continuing practicing?
My favorite, the last one was when we all came together, the practical exercise that we did. We had to put together a 30 minute program, and all our ideas came together. And then we also and on top of the ideas, we have to think about the sports. And you know, because we were diverse, we were able to put together something that was fun. And you know, what's special about 4EB being a multicultural station sharing 50 different languages.
I'm Alistair McNee, otherwise known as A Flying Scotsman, on A Wee Bit of Scotland shows, Thursdays from 2 till 4 and on Global, every Sunday from 2 till 3.
Fantastic, Alistair. So you've been involved in this training for the Sports Newsroom. What do you think about the training and what you've learned about it?
I am very pleasantly surprised. I knew it was going to be good, but having someone of Amanda Shalala from ABC, her background being able to teach us and impart some of her knowledge onto us has just been absolutely magnificent. I didn't know what to expect when I first came in, but just the breadth of what they've taught us, my interviewing skills, being able to ask questions from that experience has just been, won't just help me here with the sports broadcasting, but also with my normal interviewing skills and also in my daily life. I absolutely loved it.
What are the highlights of this training that you can take out of the training?
The first one was the visit to A Studios. Just magnificent to see how they do it professionally. Asking clear and concise questions, not leading the interviewee on, and actually giving space and silence.
So one of the things that, well, my understanding about the Sports Newsroom is to give more representation to culturally and linguistically diverse journalists, mm-hmm. to be able to do the questions to sports athletes, etc. What are your thoughts about that? Do you think this kind of training will empower CAL communities into reporting into sports and be connected with their communities in terms of sports?
You just have to have a look at the people that we've had here through this this whole experience. So we've got Samoans, Serbians, Irish, Mexicans, Spanish, Argentinian, Filipinos, and apologies to anyone else that I've missed. It is a magnificent to see how everyone has grouped together and is bouncing ideas off each other.
Participant Alistair McNee speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from 4EB. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.